The committee will come to order. We don't have quorum just yet, I don't think. No, we do not. So we'll begin this morning with a presentation from the Department of Health, and they'll be reporting on the long-term care workforce in Minnesota. It's my understanding that MDH and DEET work together on the presentation, but Health will be presenting. Their staff from DEET here, if members do have questions. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. As you suggested, there are a number of state agencies that take looks at various aspects of the state's worker preparation and workforce from a number of different angles. The Department of Employment and Economic Development looks at the economy as a whole. The Office of Higher Education looks, obviously, at the higher education system and the preparation and worker training that goes on within the higher education system. At the Health Department, we're the place that focuses closely on the healthcare workforce. So I do appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. And as you mentioned, you're going to see information from several different sources. And depending on where you want to go, I think we've got everybody here to tell you what you need to know, what you want to know. And with that, let me begin. Before looking at the healthcare workforce, and members, I believe, in addition to what you have on the screen, you should have copies of this in your packets this morning as well. Before we look at the healthcare workforce, let's try and put it in context to the overall economy and look at how the healthcare workforce fits in that economy. You can see that 14% of the jobs in Minnesota are in the healthcare sector. That sector is expected to have a 23% growth in the decade between 2012 and 2022. So it's growing much faster than employment as a whole, which you can see is projected at 7% below the pie chart there on the left. What are the biggest jobs, types of jobs in the healthcare sector? You can see that on the next slide. Registered nurses are the largest. The list goes on down. You can see that jobs in the long-term care sector, home health aides, nursing assistants, LPNs, medical assistants, are among the biggest in the sector as a whole. Moving on to the topic of this morning, the long-term care workforce, you can see on the next slide that 25% of the jobs in that healthcare sector are in the long-term care part of the sector, in the long-term care workforce. According to DEET, that's 103,000 jobs, and in that decade, 2012 to 22, that's expected to increase 16% to almost 120,000 jobs. Looking within the long-term care sector, this next slide is a little busy. It has the entire economy and the healthcare sector in those top two bars. Under the long-term care sector, you can see that as a whole, it's projected to grow 16%. But I think we start to see some interesting distinctions when we look at kind of the subcomponents of the long-term care sector. You can see that the fastest employment growth in the long-term care sector is expected to be within that category called community care, which includes assisted living. And in the contrast, that bottom bar there, skilled nursing is expected to grow most slowly. And again, given the trends that we know about in movement to assisted living and other non-institutional settings, that's probably not surprising, but here's some data to back up to document what we know. And again, diving down into the long-term care sector, we can see the greatest number of jobs by type of jobs within the sector. Diving even further to nursing homes, to skilled nursing facilities, we can see the makeup of employment within the nursing home sector. So a little bit different. Not surprisingly, when you look outside the nursing home, you see that home health aides are the largest number of jobs within the nursing home. It's nursing assistants and LPNs. So recapping, and this is a lot of this is information that you've heard in your meetings so far this session.
I think we have a question here, Representative Considine.
I'd just like to know the difference.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you. Could you tell me the difference between home health aides and personal care aides?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, probably not as precisely as you'd like. home health aides, I think, have a broader scope of responsibilities. Personal care aides, I think, focus on the specific care needs of the individual. Did I get that anywhere? Any help there? Did I get that right? I'm getting some nods.
Thank you.
All right. Sure. Mr. Schoenbaum.
So moving on to this recap, long-term care workforce comprises 103,000 workers, significant growth expected in the next decade. And as you have already heard this session, there are always many open positions in the long-term care sector with both registered nursing and other jobs in the long-term care sector. There is high turnover, even though most nurses start in long-term care upon graduation. You heard a couple of weeks ago from the state demographer, who kind of talked about the statewide trends in aging and employment and migration regionally. You're familiar with that. Let's dive in for a couple of moments to how that plays out and creates this demand for workers in the long-term care sector. The Institute of Medicine is part of the National Academies of Science, which were formed by Abraham Lincoln in 1863. And they have convened expert panels to dive into, in the Institute of Medicine, topics in the health and healthcare system periodically. A few years ago, they took a look at aging issues and their implications for the healthcare workforce. And here we start to see some of the health-related effects of those broader trends that the demographer presented a couple weeks ago. Some of this is pretty obvious, but again, I think it bears at least a quick review. because it affects the topic of the day. So older people have used more services. That older slice, you can see here, uses a disproportionate amount of physician visits, hospital stays, prescriptions, and so on. Within the long-term care workforce itself, or to serve our aging population, in addition to the workers that we've talked about in nursing homes and community services, there are not enough specialists within medicine. Not enough geriatricians, it's not an attractive specialty, not enough geriatric psychiatrists, and perhaps getting closer to nursing homes and assisted living and home-based services, you can see that less than 1% of nurses and pharmacists and less than 4% of specialists, of social workers, specialize in geriatrics or have much training to prepare them to work with this growing population. To nurses specifically, you can see that only a third are trained in a curriculum that requires an exposure to geriatrics.
Mr. Schoenbaum, we have a question from Representative Newton.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point on the geriatrics, they don't work in nursing homes, so where would the geriatricians and the geriatric psychiatrists be employed?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, few physicians work directly in nursing homes all the time, but many have, probably not enough, but they often have a practice, a broader clinic or hospital practice that includes a cohort of nursing home patients or nursing home and assisted living or homebound patients are transported to the clinic to see a geriatrician or a geriatric psychiatrist. So in terms of, and that's again a growing demand, so they tend to serve older patients but not in a nursing home.
Thank you.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are some of the specific conditions of people as they age that lead to feed this demand for services? You can see the slide here on disabilities and limitations. Again, this is all pretty basic stuff, but I think it helps set the stage for what the committee is covering. And some more specifics on worker turnover in the sector from the Institute of Medicine. I think these figures are consistent with the more Minnesota-specific figures that you've heard from the associations that are in communication with the committee. At the Health Department, we also collect information, detailed information, on a variety of licensed occupations, including registered nurses. I think we'll be discussing today the choices and challenges that nurses have in deciding where to work. We survey nurses and ask them, both look at their address, their employment address, and ask them about their work settings. And you can see that most recently, 9% of nurses worked in long-term care facilities. When we turn to LPNs, and again, you'll recall this is one of the biggest job categories in long-term care, a third of LPNs work in long-term care, but they have other choices as well. Physical therapy is important in rehab and addressing the needs of older Minnesotans. You can see that only 9% of physical therapists work in a long-term care facility, a trend that I think is important to be aware of is that similar to advanced practice nursing, physical therapy is a profession that is moving towards a doctorate degree as the entry-level practice degree. So it's going to take longer to train physical therapists in the future, and that education is probably going to be more expensive. There may be implications for, again, the factors that physical therapy graduates consider when deciding what to take.
I think we have another question for you, Mr. Schoenbaum. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenbaum, I guess I'm, is that by choice the physical therapists are moving up the ladder with more education? Is it by more requirement? I'm surprised by that, to hear that that level is escalating. I know how important they are, but I'm just, your read on why you're seeing the need of more doctorate degrees.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Baker, I don't have a great answer to the why question. I can tell you that, again, in advanced practice nursing and physical therapy and I think a couple other professions, the profession itself and its educational component and the accrediting bodies that accredit both education and the occupation have over recent years moved towards what is sometimes called credential creep. Probably not a friendly term, but that's what it's called. And we find that at work here in physical therapy. It's, I think if we had members of the profession here, they would tell you it's recognizing the need and the importance of those occupations.
We have another question from Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the physical therapists, again, and moving to doctorates, would that be similar to being a doctor of chiropractic medicine, which I believe is a two-year program?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, again, we're getting into an area where I can't claim a lot of depth. In physical therapy and advanced practice nursing, the previous entry-level credential was a master's degree, and the doctoral program in these occupations is longer than the master's degree, so I think there is a difference between those occupations and chiropractic.
All right. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Just quickly, in addition to thinking about supply and demand, we also know that there are distribution issues that come into play when we look at any part of the workforce, and especially in the healthcare workforce. So not just what careers people choose to enter, but where geographically they choose to work can create challenges to meeting the needs of the population. And very quickly, looking at how that plays out in some occupations, some more related to long-term care than others. The health department does work on behalf of the federal government to analyze areas of the state as to whether shortages exist in some professions. And looking at this next series of maps, we see that most of the state is designated as a mental health shortage area. Most of the state is designated as a shortage area for dental services for the low-income population. A good deal of the state is designated as a shortage area for primary care providers. And these shortages occur not just in greater Minnesota, but also in the metro area, both in dental and in primary care. We've talked a little bit about physical therapy. When we look at the needs of the aging population and those spending time in long-term care facilities, I think it's interesting to look at how many of what we call ancillary professions, again, probably not the friendliest word for those occupations, but therapy and ancillary professionals do work in long-term care. Putting the presentation together for this morning, I was struck again by how few of these occupations are found in long-term care settings, and maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised that the largest group of these ancillary professions working within long-term care also are social workers and mental health counselors. That's the, I think, the quick tour of the facts and figures on the long-term care workforce. I know part of your charge is to respond to the challenges and the needs that those facts and figures point to. And those of you that have heard me present before have seen this diagram. So as you start to think, and as we at the health department start to think of how can, should, might state government or others respond to the workforce needs in any given sector, we find it useful to look at what we call this workforce development pipeline, which starts with preparing K-12 kids and college students in the basic math, science skills, health literacy needed to be ready for a health career, to recruit them into health professions and health career training and education, to locate that education in high need areas so they can get experience and see the satisfactions that can be available by working in the areas where we need them to work once they graduate. As we've seen, they have lots of choices, so it can be important to encourage them to work where they're most needed. As you're also discussing in this committee, the healthcare system is changing rapidly, and that has employment implications given the scale of the needs for healthcare workers. We as a society are probably not going to be able to simply train our way out of the shortages that are expected and just produce more, so the changes in the healthcare system are also important, and once we have people in place, we need to keep them there, and you've heard about turnover challenges in the long-term care industry. The bills that you're going to be considering today touch a couple parts, a couple segments of this pipeline. I know at least one of the bills is about scholarships to help long-term care workers advance, and that is my mouse showing up on the screen there? No. Anyway, that that kind of touches those second and mainly that second link in the pipeline of helping people get the training they need through scholarships and other incentives. And the bills before you also relate to the state's health professional loan forgiveness program, and that's a strategy that is related to that first greenish box in the pipeline to encourage grads to seek employment where their need is needed most through incentives like loan forgiveness. Mr. Chairman and members, that kind of completes the overview. If there are no questions, I can go on and talk a little bit about the loan forgiveness program, which the health department administers.
I'm not seeing any questions here, Mr. Schoenbaum, so please continue.
I will, again, provide a little background on the loan forgiveness program. The bills before you today are not health department bills, but we do manage the program, so we thought it might be helpful to provide a little background. The you have some, there'll be some slides on this, and you also have a handout in your packet on the loan forgiveness program. The state provides incentives to graduates in certain occupations to work in high-need areas through repaying a portion of their student debt. That is a state program that the legislature began in the 1990s. You see some of its history on the first page of your handout, and if you flip the handout over, you will see down the left-hand column the current occupations that are eligible for loan forgiveness and the conditions, the settings where they must serve in order to be eligible to receive a loan forgiveness payment. So it ranges from a rural community requirement for physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants and pharmacists of particular interest to this committee. Nurses must work in a nursing home or facility for the developmentally disabled to be eligible to receive the state's loan forgiveness incentives. Dentists and nurse faculty are also part of the program. The program has been formally evaluated periodically over the years, and also on the back page of your handout you can see a recent analysis that we did by looking at where previous participants in the program currently practice, and both over the years and with this most recent analysis, we're pretty pleased that the program, that most of them stay in the same or a similar setting for 5, 10, and sometimes even 20 years. So the theory that the hypothesis of the program that loan forgiveness is both an incentive to attract people to work where they're most needed, it's a recruitment incentive, and it has a retention effect that particularly new graduates starting out in their first jobs, those jobs have a long-term impact and influence on where people choose to work during their careers. The monitoring and evaluation results seem to verify that there's also a strong retention effect in the program. Turning back to the presentation for a moment, last year the legislature created a healthcare workforce commission. We were honored that the legislature asked the health department to help staff that commission. We had a series of meetings last year. Representative Schumacher was a member of the commission. The commission looked at some of the same data and facts and figures that we've covered this morning somewhat more broadly, and they had a specific charge to look at the primary care workforce. They found that the kinds of needs we're talking about, especially related to that distribution challenge, that geographic factor in the healthcare workforce, is in play. in rural Minnesota especially, which faces a variety of challenges, and looking at the loan forgiveness program, they recommended that programs like that, and specifically the loan forgiveness program, should be continued and perhaps expanded.
Mr. Schoenbaum, I believe we have a question from Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the minimum requirement for physicians, nurses? Is it all the same or different? If you want to get into this program, what's the minimum of time you have to serve?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine, the program runs annual application cycles for each of these occupations. We review people's suitability for practice, their past experience, their education, and whatever the condition may be. They have to make a minimum 3-year commitment to practice in whatever the setting is, whether it's a nursing home or a rural community. They have to make a minimum 3-year commitment. If they don't fulfill that commitment, they have to pay the funds back with interest. They're also allowed, so this is a serious commitment. They are also allowed to renew for a fourth year. And the amount that each occupation is eligible for each year, if you look at the slide, I don't think you have this in a handout, or on a, it's not on the handout, but it's the last slide in the PowerPoint, you can see that the amount is based on the average debt for graduates in each eligible occupation. And the annual amount is set at 15% of that average debt, so that if a participant remains in the program for 4 years, the state will have contributed on average, will have paid off 60% of their student debt. Every individual is different, but the program uses these averages, and that's the idea.
Representative Considine?
And the requirement is the same through all professions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine, the 3-year requirement, yes, it is.
All right.
One more.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The award amount for physicians, $25,000. If they only had, say, $75,000 in debt, would that go down, or would they get their all $75,000 off in 3 years?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine, great question. No, we will own, the state will not pay a participant more than they have in debt.
So it's based on...
Representative Considine.
Sorry, I'll get these things... thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's based on a percentage then every time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Considine, it is based on these amounts. If, in your instance, a physician has $75,000 in debt, they would get $25,000 each year. When their debt was gone, they would get no more.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's about it. I mean, I did a quick kind of look at what's in the bills before you, but I think that's the end of my remarks. Happy to be a resource to the authors or other questions, but I think that completes my prepared presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. We do have a few questions for you, starting with Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schoenbaum. I'm going back to your slide 19, the direct care workers turnover. That to me is, you kind of skimmed over that pretty fast, and I just would like to have further conversation about that, especially your last bullet item. You know, the reason really is the cost. I mean, it's huge. So $4.1 billion of expense is going off to, you know, to recruit new folks and to deal with the turnover, and so that, I mean, that puts a number to the thing, you know, the doctors and, I mean, everything we're talking about here. But you didn't really speak about the whole workforce. So what are we doing with all the workers? I mean, is there something that we can help for, you know, for the cleaners to encourage them to stay? I'm guessing they're turning over as well and maybe going to work at Aldi's or Fleet Farm or something. I imagine there's a wage component. Is there a housing component? Is there other incentives we can offer to the whole workforce to encourage them to stay? And because that's just kind of my continuing harp in this whole thing is, you know, to take care of folks. I think we need the continuity and, the lack of, just to diminish the turnover. So can you go a little deeper into this this slide?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, sure. I can only go a little deeper, but I bet there are people in the audience that can tell you more. As you know, the work in long-term care is so important, and it's so hard, and people do have other choices for the same or better wages. I know that's a theme that you've been looking at in this committee all session and will probably continue. I'm not the best person to kind of give you the full list of all those challenges.
Is there anyone from the that's in the audience today that could help Mr. Schoenbaum out with that question? Maybe someone from DEED? I'm not seeing anyone jumping up for that. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Lee?
Mr. Chair, and it's just kind of the continuing interest in the, trying to maintain the workforce. I don't, just recently in the paper we have another concern of mine is there was an example of like Traverse County, for example, which I have to be honest, I don't know a lot about. But, reading it, it's, their demographics, in the last couple of years, their county is basically halved. So imagine that same scenario here in the metro. So half of Hennepin County leaves. So obviously you lose a lot of workers too. So, in this case, it's 8,000 people in a county. I mean, that leads to another question. I hate to sound like a Republican, but do we need 87 counties, really? I imagine we all have cities that are bigger than 8,000 folks. But so
not
here's
all of us, Representative Lee. Not all of us.
Well, you have a few cities, don't you? Of course.
We're hoping for 5,000 someday, but
yes.
Not yet.
So, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Representative Lilly, I do know a little bit about Traverse County, and Traverse County, I think, is very telling. I think Traverse County may be one of those canary in the coal mine counties in Minnesota, because not only is it a small county with a declining population, but if the share of that population over 65 is not 30% yet, it's darn near close to that.
Right.
And that's what much of the state is going to be looking like within 10 or 15 years.
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Lewis,
to the testifier, that's exactly what I was, just wondering what's going on. And then bigger scope, how do you, so you've got this worst case scenario happening, so how do you get folks then to go out there or to keep these jobs or to keep the ones out there working? And then the workforce is changing, of course, and so it's all these things going on. So I'm not sure in that case tuition's going to cut it myself. But, I always keep thinking that, what was that movie, where they smash some doctor going through town with smashes Porsche or something. So maybe that's how you do it, too. You just, Doc Hollywood, right? We're going to have to do more of that in Minnesota, I think, pies and those sort of things. But, think about another one is like Ely, Minnesota, where, I'm kind of an outdoors person, and I just can't imagine there isn't a doctor that would go up there and deliver babies. It's fascinating to me. So, just these continuing staffing questions. But anyways, sorry, I'm off topic perhaps.
Anything to that, Mr. Schoenbaum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, Doc Hollywood was a fun movie. There was also a TV series called Northern Exposure, which was set in Alaska, which is not that different than Ely. And the lead character there was there because of loan repayment. So, just another interesting example.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schoenbaum. I just want to make sure I'm interpreting this new findings chart right. But it looks like the number of participants in the five-year category is much, much lower than in, like, the 20 years. And it would seem to me that I could see people starting in it and leaving, but the numbers seem to be fairly minimal. So am I interpreting that right?
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, I think there's some artifacts. We reached out to past participants, and we also looked in the licensing databases to try and find addresses for participants. And in some of these categories, we found more people than others. I think particularly, and I know it's a subject that will be before you in a moment, in the nurse loan forgiveness category, you know, as we've been discussing, there are so many factors, drivers, influences on how long nurses remain in a nursing home that I think that contributes to some of the lower numbers in that occupation.
Representative Yaruso, or sorry, Representative Mason.
No, I was just thanking him.
Oh, okay. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Representative Mason's question, so when we look at the chart, just looking at the top one, the rural physician, so the number, if we look at the 20 years, the 192 participants, those are the people you found, correct? So I believe what you were saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that these numbers are skewed somewhat because the high percent of people who stayed in the area might reflect the fact that those are the people you found, because I would assume you're far more likely to continue to find the person if they stay put. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaruso, no, you're right. I think the retention number, the 149, say, in the 20 years, are the people that we found. The 192 are the physicians that have went through the program 20 years ago. In contrast, in the nurse loan forgiveness category, I don't know why that's... Oh, yeah, it's just participants who responded. I'm going to have to get back to you. It says in the nurse one, it's participants who responded to the survey. The others, it's participants entirely. So I think in the top, I think we got a problem in that 5-year cell there. I think we got a problem in that 5-year cell.
Follow up from Senator Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it would seem that you must have had at least some that participated in the survey that weren't still in their area. And so we're either missing a line, you know, or something. It would be good to get to find out if that participants in all of those actually means participants who responded, because I think that would clarify those high numbers we're getting in the later years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaruso, we will do that, and I will get back to you. Again, I think the nurse category, particularly in the early years of their career, they are so mobile that we lost a number of them.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't so much for Mr. Schoenbaum, but Representative Lilly's point kind of made me want to just add a comment to that, which is that when we think about some of these counties where the demographics are changing so severely that we're going to have so many elderly people and so few younger workers, it really points to the reason why the politics of divisiveness really doesn't work. Whether it's urban versus rural, whether it's old versus young, we're really all in this together. And this is one of the reasons, you know, it's great that we have this committee this year and that we're talking about these issues. They're really important. But to get this committee, the new majority eliminated the Young Kids Committee. And I really think that we can't afford to not think about the young, because who is going to take care of the old? You know, this is really, you can't separate things out in that way. We really, from my point of view, we really, even more than the elderly, need to be talking about their grandchildren. And how are we making sure that every single child in this state is going to be, you know, the best they can possibly be and be ready to take over as more and more people retire? And I really fear that we're not doing that sufficiently. And I'm interested, as we move forward with these, you know, proposals that are absolutely great. I mean, we should be doing more loan forgiveness and all of these things. But we also need to be thinking about the changing demographics of our young people. Our state is more and more heavily not white. And are we reaching out to the ethnic communities and making sure that all of those different communities that we are, paying attention to the gaps? I mean, here I am in the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee talking about equity, health equity, education equity. This is important because it matters to our elderly, even our elderly in the nursing homes in the rural areas. We can't deal with a shortage of workers without paying attention to what we're doing with all of our young people and making sure that every single one of them is prepared for the future. Because at the end of the day, those are our resources to deal with our economy in so many dimensions, not just our healthcare sector. So I just wanted to put that in, lest we forget that we can't talk about the elderly without talking about the young.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back and address the concerns that Representative Lilly had, if I understood them properly. I live, it's funny when you said we all have towns larger than 5,000. I only have one, or 10,000. I have one that's 5,500. I live in a town of 500. I grew up in what was called a small suburb of 30,000 in Chicago. And when I moved to Iowa City, before I moved here, I thought I fell off the face of the earth. Who could want to live in Iowa City? Now I live in a town of 500. So I think there is a little bit of a presumption that if you grow up urban, that why would you want to move to lower populations in greater Minnesota? Because I think the tone of some of this loan forgiveness is we kind of encourage people to come out and check out locations like West Central Minnesota, and then we hope that they stay. I worked on a handful of different projects on workforce development in the Willmar area. One was very specific to just internships, and all it did was it had internships for 1 year, and two were in an animal vaccine company, and one was in an engineering company in Willmar. Both very high tech, both very high paying jobs. We had four interns that came up for the year, two in each. None of them were from the area. All of them went to major schools. All of them intended to go back to where they came from after they did this internship. Three of the four ended up staying. The fourth went back for more education and came back to Willmar after that. So there is, I think, the loan forgiveness is that it's sort of, I don't want to misrepresented, but is it sort of a way to entice them out there, other than the direct reason of living out in places like that? Perhaps, and I think this really does apply to nursing homes also. The people that are in the profession say, well, I'd never want to work in a nursing home. You get them exposed to these experiences, and they spend a little bit of time there, and they tend to stick, and they tend to like it. So, you know, kind of when we talk about greater Minnesota, we have the lakes, we have lifestyle, we have certain things that people do want to live out there. And so if we have just some simple way with loan repayment, if that gets more doctors, more nurses, more CNAs, all these different people out to us, or it gets us in the nursing homes, they will stick, they will retain. I believe that will happen just because once they're there, they will understand what it's like to be in those areas. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative
Mr. Chair, just perhaps...
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Quick comment. Excellent point. There are all kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds that apply to the loan forgiveness program, and even though the research shows that the person most likely to work in a rural area is a person who grew up in a rural area, when those people graduate with new credentials, they have lots of choices. They're going to get recruited all over. Loan forgiveness can be a tool that helps kind of helps them kind of go back to the area they came from, even after they've seen the big lights in the big city.
Hello, Mr. Representative Miller.
Yes, one more small point, if I could, because this actually came up with we have a thank you, Mr. Chair. We have I have a nurse practitioner who emailed me somewhat coincidentally a couple days ago in the city of Benson, and she has major loan debts. And this kind of addresses some of the pay issues that might help support what you're saying. She says she wants to stay in Benson. She doesn't know with her loans if she can stay in Benson, so she just, I don't know that she knows that all these bills are going around, because she just said, can you do something to maybe help this? I'd like to stay in the area. That's one of the burdens. One of the things that we have also seen in our area that I just kind of want to punctuate is even the young people who live in our towns go away, they have a propensity to come back home over time. The reason why they go away to begin with is to find the work to pay off their loans. And when they're done with that, they have a tendency to come back.
All right. Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller and Dr. Schoenbaum have touched on what I was going to ask. Is when we're looking at the number of participants in the programs, can we identify how many of them came from rural areas and returned to rural areas? Is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, we probably could. We haven't. It'd take kind of pouring through kind of files of applications. It's doable, but we haven't done it.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be important. You know, because in some ways that would then be, these programs would be a subsidy for people from rural areas to remain in rural areas rather than attempting to attract people from the more urban or suburban areas to go to the rural. I have a second question somewhat relating to the loan forgiveness program chart that we have. The first three categories, you have rural physician, rural mid-level, rural pharmacist, and then when you get to nurse and dentist, it's not rural. Is there a reason for that? And to follow on to that, the bills we're going to be hearing today, my understanding is that it not only includes loan forgiveness for rural areas, but also for high poverty areas in metropolitan areas.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, the categories and the selection of the high need area, the condition for each of these occupations, is always set by the legislature. It's in law. And over the years, as needs have come to the legislature, it's modified the program accordingly. So it began as a rural program. Long-term care issues have been on the radar before, and that's how the condition for the nurse profession was added. Dental access issues, you know, are a regular concern of the legislature, and that's how that one came into being. So each time the legislature acts or amends, the list changes.
All right. Representative Mason.
Thank you. First of all, a comment. One of my friends, who is an occupational therapist, went to China for a tour. I'm thinking this may be about 8 years ago. And what she was finding there is because of their one-child program, they were now starting to have nursing programs. And she was saying that it was really difficult for the people to talk about the nursing homes because it was such a severe culture change. And we're doing a lot of that here as well, trying to get, we've had, the way we've been brought up, it's all about the young, and now trying to focus again on the senior citizens, I think, is a problem. And I don't know how we're going to be able to address some of the changes. I mean, we've got so many senior populations that are in isolation. And we've been deliberately doing that. And I remember somebody from one of our, can't remember the name, it was the organization that deals with standards for teaching, but he said, we're the only civilization that has ever created a divide among our age groups. And so those are just comments. But going back to your new findings again, when you said you couldn't find addresses, these people are all licensed, right? So don't you have to have the current addresses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, not if they've left Minnesota.
Okay. All right, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker. I just you got to keep in mind, and all of us probably know the state better than you think we do, and. We get around. You're Wilmer's, that's where you're from, right?
Mr. Chair, I'm from Princeburg.
Princeburg, but
yep.
You have Wilmer part of your district?
No.
No? Well, Wilmer, for example, you brought up, is really no different than my district. I mean, in many ways, you've got all the fast food places and it's very similar. I've been to your town and got a nice bakery at the gas station. I don't know if you eat any pastries, you look pretty lean. But, you might not even looked at the graph, but we really are one Minnesota. The problems that I mentioned in Traverse County are really similar. You might have skipped over it, but there's an urban map, and there's really a lot of underserved folks in the metro. And so I think, you know, we all have to be careful and realize that these problems are statewide, not just in one area. And but the Traverse County, I'll stick with it. It's a concern where folks are leaving and how are we gonna. So it was purely intended as far as Traverse County. So,
Representative Miller, briefly.
Very briefly, I just want to concur with Representative Lilly. I didn't want to disregard the rest of the state. I was just trying to punctuate a kind of. Trying to help understand like a Traverse County sort of situation, so thank you. Thank you for explaining, absolutely.
Okay, kumbaya, members. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I want to ask anything anymore. That's not true. Actually, I have a niece who's right now trying to get her degree in nursing, and it's been quite a challenge. And we're not hearing about how hard it is to get a nursing degree now for our young folks. And what strikes me really interestingly as well is she does have her certification for nursing assistant. And when her class schedule changes because of semester changes, she will shop the nursing homes to see which one will fit her schedule best. And I talked to one of the gentlemen in our area who's the director of one of the nursing homes, and he says they do have that problem, and quite frankly they just go with it because they do have people who are trained to come in and out where retention is really cost effective. You want to keep your people so you don't have to keep doing the training, but this is what's happening. And so my question is, and I'm not sure if you know this, but are we having difficulty finding folks to, number one, graduate with the nursing degrees to fulfill all the positions that are available too? Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Mr. Schoenbaum?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tice, it certainly does. And again, I don't have a lot of depth in this. I would, I think, look to the employers to share their perspective on some of these nuances. We do know that there are many more applicants to nursing programs than there are nursing school slots available, and again, one of the reasons for that is attracting faculty is hard, and there is one of the loan forgiveness categories for nursing faculty.
Representative Tice, any follow-up? All right, any other questions for Mr. Schoenbaum today? All right, seeing none, well, thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum, for your insightful presentation and all the knowledge that you bring to us each time.
Back at you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, I will, now that we have a quorum, officially call the meeting to order. And we are going to start with Representative Baker and his bill this morning. And as he is getting ready, I will note it was brought to my attention from Representative Lee that the roll call was not included in the minutes for this week, and so I apologize for that error. We will make that fix and bring the minutes back next week for approval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Baker, would you like to move House File 614?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, and good morning, members of the committee. I am proud this morning to introduce House File 614 and recommend recommend the bill to Greater Minnesota Workforce as the next step of here of this committee. The overall goal of House File 614 is to help providers recruit and train the caregiving workforce that we need today and in the future. It proposes several strategies that will help address the issues they face in recruitment, training, and retention, including the following. Expansion of the Loan Forgiveness Program to include nursing program graduates who are RNs and LPNs, and it also reduces service obligations for those nurses. What we're looking at is actually reducing the minimum requirement from 3 years down to 2 years. Expansion of the Nursing Facility Scholarship Program to allow for loan forgiveness for newly hired nurses. The bill also proposes to expand the scholarship program to cover additional expenses, including child care and transportation. Allow a rate increase for nursing homes to recover expenses for those related training nursing assistants. And finally, establishing a long-term care grant program through the Department of DEED to advance long-term care careers. The bill would also fund a study through DEED to explore additional tax credits or other hiring incentives that may help those providers. I'd like to call forward some testifiers today, starting with Aaron Buey and also Carrie Thurlow, if they could join me for the initial testifying. And I stand ready for questions at the right time, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Before your presentation, if it's all right, we're going to take up the amendments for the bill so that we have it in order, and your testimony can reflect that then. The first amendment I have here is the A1 amendment, and I believe Representative Newton, were you planning to offer that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. And would you like to have me explain that the amendment, Mr. Chair?
If you would, please.
Some years ago, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we approved a dental therapist program in Minnesota. And the intent of the program was to make up for the lack of dentists in rural areas and in high-density urban areas where we have high amounts of poverty. And so I think this fits in well with the bill that's being presented, and would like to ask that it be accepted by the author.
Representative Baker?
Mr. Chair, we welcome that amendment to the draft.
All right. Is there any other discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, say no. Amendment is adopted. I also have here the A3 amendment. Representative Yaruso, are you planning to offer that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A3 amendment adds newly trained nursing assistants to the people that could qualify for the scholarships. This section is on page 2 of the bill. If you look at line 2.10, the bill adds newly hired and recently graduated registered nurses and licensed practical nurses. My amendment would, in addition, add training expenses for newly hired and recently graduated nursing assistants. We saw in the previous presentation that a very large fraction of the people that are working in nursing homes and assisted living facilities are CNAs, certified nursing assistants. The programs to become certified are not degree programs, and so they're often not eligible for some of the student loan programs. However, they do cost money. They don't cost the tens of thousands of dollars but often the people that are going into those programs are the people of the least means, and we have very high turnover rates. There was a turnover rate listed of 71% in the previous presentation. And we've heard a lot of testimony about how difficult it is to hire and keep our nursing assistants. And those are the people that work the most hands-on day-to-day with the people that we're talking about that need the care. So that's what it's about, and I hope the author would accept it.
All right, Representative Garuso moves the A3 amendment. I did have one question for you, Representative Garuso.
Yes.
When I was reading through the amendment, I could take it a couple different ways, and I just wanted to make sure, when you're talking about newly hired and recently graduated, you're talking about those as separate. You don't have to be both newly hired and recently graduated to get this. You can be newly hired as well as recently graduated. Is that your intention, right?
It was intended to parallel the language that was offered for the registered nurses and licensed practical nurses.
Okay.
And not being a lawyer, I would hesitate to suggest how that would get interpreted.
But your effort, Representative Urizo, is to expand?
Yes.
To include these. Okay, thank you. Representative Baker, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Urizo, I, with that clarification as well, I kind of had the same question, but I like the intent, and I think nursing assistants should be included in this language, so I would welcome the amendment.
All right, any other discussion to the amendment? See no other discussion. All in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. That is all the amendments I have. So we'll go back to testimony. And Ms. Thurlow, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Leading Age Minnesota and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm going to keep my testimony very brief because I know we have some providers here that can really speak to how helpful this bill will be. But I just want to make a couple of points. First, I want to thank Representative Baker for bringing this forward. And I know that there are other additional bills coming forward to address workforce needs this session. I will share with you that on behalf of my members, workforce is the number one issue that they talk about. And I know you've heard from several providers already this session. You'll hear from more. It is the number one thing that keeps them up at night, is the thing that makes it difficult for them to continue to fulfill their missions to meet the needs of seniors in our communities. And so any tools available to help address recruitment, retention, and training of our caregiving workforce as we prepare for this aging community is vitally needed. As we are reminded that 60,000 Minnesotans will turn 65 this year, and every year for several years now in the foreseeable future, we know we have to get ready. And this bill represents a package of proposals that will help that. The last thing I would say is just very quickly, Leading Age Minnesota, it's very appropriate that this bill is being heard today as we kicked off, on behalf of Leading Age Minnesota, our Institute of Older Adult Services, where we are hosting over 4,000 caregivers from all over the state. And I know that one of their top issues that they will be looking at during their convention is workforce issues. So very appropriate that it's being talked about today, and really appreciate the work on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Erin Bowie. I am the Director of Government Affairs with the Care Providers of Minnesota. I, too, am here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative this morning. I also want to thank Representative Baker for bringing his bill forward. We support his efforts to enhance workforce development programs in the long-term care field. And we do have providers who have come in to talk about their personal experiences with workforce issues in the long-term care field. And at this point in time, we'd like them to come to the table.
Okay, and it looks like we have Deb Barnes and Dave Lucia to give testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dave Lucia, and I'm the Vice President of Human Resources with Tillwood Senior Living. I'm also the chairperson for the American Healthcare Association Workforce Committee. I'm a member of the Minnesota Care Providers Education Committee, and I also hold a PhD in human resource development from the University of Minnesota. So I clearly have an interest in workforce development and clearly interested in healthcare. Tealwood has nursing and assisted living facilities across the state. We have the opportunity to care for seniors at our facilities in urban, suburban, and rural locations. Our communities, families, caregivers, and the state are facing a daunting challenge in the years coming. Minnesota will see 60,000 new seniors each year in the coming age wave. For the first time, seniors will outnumber school children, and this trend will not change in the foreseeable future. These statistics mean two things for to us as care providers. We're going to see more demand for services, and we're going to need a significant increase in our quality caregivers. Currently, some of the biggest challenges facing our facilities and regions are difficulties in recruiting and retaining the caregivers who provide the quality care to our seniors. Our wages and benefits just aren't competitive with other employers, both for entry-level positions and our nursing positions. While the majority of new graduates of nursing programs start their careers in senior care facilities, by the time they hit the 18-month mark, they're routinely recruited away to hospitals. They pay tens of thousands of, literally tens of thousands of dollars per year higher. This is a real force that's affecting our ability to retain and develop our workforce. Additionally, I'd like to note the unique environment that long-term care workers work in. I honestly can't think of many more environments that are so demanding, so critical, demand such high level of interpersonal skills, yet are paying $10 an hour, $11 an hour, maybe. Those are very stressful situations with very high demands, often young workers, often workers entering the field with their first work experience. So it's a continuing struggle that really needs to be addressed. We see pressures all the time, large retailers, manufacturing. Most of the routine day shifts in long-term care start at 6 a.m. Rural areas, the wintertime, you're getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get to work. I mean, those are not attractive jobs for $10. It doesn't take much for a large retailer. I can personally tell you of areas where manufacturers, plants have come in, offering $10, $11, $12, $14 an hour for assembly workers. Where am I going to be? I'm not going to be getting up at 6 a.m. going into long-term care facilities. So it's really a pressure, and it really impacts our ability to provide quality care. Dr. Castle with the American Healthcare Association has done a very in-depth study and has shown some direct correlations to turnover and quality of care. And his study indicates that as we exceed 40% in turnover, there's an direct inverse correlation with quality. It drops in a complete inverse relationship. I think there was a figure that was demonstrated today that our CNAs are averaging 71% turnover. I think that speaks to the issue. Quality care is best provided with a consistent, stable workforce. That is why investment in workforce development is important to us. In my opinion, we need to make a fundamental shift away from thinking about jobs in healthcare or long-term care to careers in long-term care. That's a fundamental shift we need to make. I believe that this bill would allow us to expand our training opportunities, give us the ability to help our nursing staff with student loan debt, and also the ability to offer hiring incentives. I believe it will help us to retain current staff, attract new individuals to the field, and provide opportunities for current staff to further their training skills. Until we are able to offer higher wages and benefits, this bill is a step in the right direction to help us bring more people into the field and to help us keep them working in the facilities and providing quality care for our seniors. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lucia. Ms. Barnes?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Baker. I'm proud to be here to testify in support of H.F. 614. My maiden name was Zimmerman, so I'm used to going last. So, yeah. So again, my name is Deb Barnes. For the record, I'm the Executive Director at Lakeview Health Services in Fairmont. I'm also the administrator at Oak Terrace and Gaylord, but I'm going to keep these comments limited to Fairmont. Workforce also is something I eat, sleep, and breathe. I'm the chair of the Workforce Committee at Leading Age, and I'm also the chair of the South Central Workforce Council in Mankato. So this bill is so exciting to me because of those extra positions. Lakeview, anyway, was built in 1964 as a mission of area Methodist churches, an outreach mission for them. So it just celebrated its 50th anniversary. We had a great community celebration, wonderful community support. Since 1964, it's grown to not only now have skilled nursing home beds, but assisted living and independent apartments as well. So to care for our seniors in assisted living and skilled care, we have to fill 156 positions. That's the challenge. Even with the community support we have and in a town of 10,000, it is wonderful. But that recruitment and retention, which has been repeated all morning, is our biggest challenge, my biggest challenge as a provider. We have 6 to 8 positions open every single, 6 to 8 lines open every single day. That equates to between 400 and 600 hours of pay period that we have to fill with overtime hours. So even though we have a negative bottom line, I have $199,000 that were spent last year just in overtime. Now, that certainly has a financial impact, but it also has an impact physically and emotionally on those people that are filling those hours. I'll tell you more about that in a little bit. I worry that as our population ages, this is going to become an even more acute challenge, and I've seen it grow year after year after year. And it's been very tiring. I remember my first issue with this was in about 1996. When someone wanted to come to our nursing home from a neighboring town and could not come because we didn't have enough staff. So we have been dealing with this since 1996. To meet the challenges, we've done a lot of things. We have sent a lot of our students to school with the scholarship money that you provided through legislation. We have a lot of people now that we're enrolling in the health support specialist program that's been started by Leading Age. We have partnered with our workforce center in Fairmont, trying to find new ways to bring people in. We offer the CNA course on site, but none of those things have yet been enough. We still need your help. I have two people that I'd like to talk to you about. One is, her name is Deb also, and she's a nurse, and she, as well as the other gentleman I'm going to talk to you about, do this because it is their Christian mission, their passion. If it were not for them, I don't know how we'd survive. Deb works 80 hours a week, every week. 80 hours. She does the job of two people, day in and day out. Without her, I don't know what we do. Another gentleman, Paul, is in his 60s. He's a CNA. He's a farmer, but he likes something else to do, so he got his CNA certificate, and he works for us. Paul is in his 60s, as I said. He has not had a day off since Christmas Eve, so I believe this would be his 48th day in a row covering extra open shifts. So everything you can do to give senior care providers more tools in this workforce challenge and dilemma and crisis, we need desperately. And Paul needs a day off. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair, I don't have so much a question, but for Ms. Barnes, you know, we attempted last week in House File 316, at least those of us in the minority party attempted to give you some of those tools by putting 100% of the funds for that bill into the salaries for the employees, and that was defeated. You know, we understand the problem, we recognize the problem, we're trying very hard to help, but we need support from the majority party as well. Thank you.
Anything to that? Representative Gunther.
You know, I agree that we should get raises for the employees. I totally agree with that. But the getting raises for the employees won't do any good if they don't have a job, because the nursing home had to close down because they couldn't keep up with their ongoing expenses. So we're in a dilemma there. And it's not an easy one. It's not easy for Deb to try to get people to work, because they will lose their benefits if they work overtime. It's a tough job out there. My father-in-law was there for 2 years. I went there 5 days a week for 2 years. And that's a kind, wonderful staff. And when she mentioned these people, I knew who they were. But you can't not pay attention to the facility itself. Increase in insurance expenses, the increase in heat, and increases in lights. You got to pay attention to them besides the staff salaries. And if I could wave my magic wand and triple their salary, I'd do it, because I know the worth of those people.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just responding to that, which wasn't why I raised my hand initially, but I think the encumbrance amendment just was with the money that was, you know, the money in the bill is in different pots, and I don't think it affected the money that was in the sort of the hard costs pot, Representative Gunther, the operations money. So somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that increase would have, you know, that those were separate things. It wouldn't have taken all of the new money and put it into those salaries. So just want to clarify that. But I really wanted to ask a question more about the bill, and I'm not really sure. I think maybe Representative Baker would be the one to answer. I'm curious about why the bill is shortening the commitment period for the nurses, because that seems to me to kind of run against what we want to do, which is make sure people are there long enough. I mean, this is a big deal. We're handing people a big pot of money in this, and it's for good reason. I think it's obviously it's a program that over the years has shown itself to be very valuable and to really achieve its goals, which, as an aside, is not always the case for some things that we do around here. This one really proves its worth. So I'm happy to, you know, hand over that money for some people for a very worthy cause. However, why in the world would we say, gee, this, we know this works, so let's require less of a commitment?
Ms. Thurlow.
Chair, Representative Liebling, if I can, the simple answer is, with a three-year commitment, we don't have very many nurses in long-term care taking advantage of the loan forgiveness program. Because of the financial kind of equation, if you will, a three-year commitment, quite frankly, is what we're hearing, is too long when they can go to a hospital and make literally tens of thousands of dollars a year more. They will bypass this particular benefit. From our viewpoint, lowering the commitment to 2 years buys us a little more time. As you heard from testimony today, we hire the bulk of new nurses out there, but within 18 months or less, they are gone to other better-paying careers. So from our viewpoint, lowering the commitment buys us a little more time with those nurses, and that's really the thinking behind that.
My apologies, Representative Baker.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was a very good question Representative Liebling had. I actually asked that question to Mr. Schobaum yesterday, because it is it's a great program. I wanted to make sure that the folks taking advantage of the three-year program weren't being shorted. We're not shortening the loan forgiveness of the 3- and 4-year students that have stayed in the business. But as we heard earlier from earlier testimony, they're finding that 18-month window is seeming to be a real key point. So I think that the folks that give us 18 months, or if we can push them to 2 years, we're still gaining 2 years of good service, which we are maybe not getting any service or they're losing out because they're leaving earlier to go to higher paid nursing positions or other related industries. So I think this is a better step in our nursing field, and especially in the nursing facilities, that makes it just a little bit easier. And if they only stay for 2 years, they still get $5,000 per year. That's a $10,000 debt forgiveness on that particular position. So it just makes it a little bit softer. I think it's better aligned for that position.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. You know, one of the things that I think it's important for us to do here in the legislature is to try as much as we can to use data to support what we want to do. And this is an issue that, you know, we've got this long track record that Mr. Schoenbaum talked about. I mean, I get what you're saying, but what I'm hearing is that, okay, so now we're going to, you know, a lot of nurses leave by 18 months, and now we're going to require them to stay only to 24 months to get what is essentially a lot of public money to get them, and our point in giving them the money, after all, is to try to get them to so love what they're doing and really get a feel for it that they'll want to stay on. And I'm just wondering, I mean, we all have the same goal here, but what data is there to show that cutting a year off the commitment will actually have the goal that you're hoping that it will? And the second part of that would be, are we going to study it to see, you know, assuming that this would pass into law, are we going to then have some way to compare to see whether that in fact helps, or does it just mean that, you know, you get more initially and they just leave at 24 months instead of 18?
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think, again, to your point, we heard earlier from Mr. Lucia that current studies or current information in the field from his operation, now I know it's only one company, if you will, that has their knowledge of this, but that 18-month window was something that they saw happening now today. So I think by us moving quickly, more quickly on this two-year change for that position will help more nurses get into that position. And by doing so, we're not paying them any more if they're only there for 2 years, because they only still get $5,000 per year. So if they choose to move on, they'll still do that. I don't think it's, in my opinion, as an employer, if I had an employee there for 2 years, and some of these care providers that are here, if I get Joe or Harry or Paul for those 2 years, now it's my job to make sure they love what they do here as much as they can. And if we didn't get them in the door because, you know, they just weren't sure, 3 years seems like, that's a little longer than I want to be here, I think that's what we're hearing in the field. And again, you know, visiting with Mr. Schoenbaum, I think that he says it's a good starting point to try to keep massaging this debt forgiveness program, and he thinks this is a good place to start with a little softer requirement. So I endorse that. I thought it was a good part of this bill. And you bring up the part of the study, which is also part of Bill 614. We have it as, I think, I'm not sure which point of it is there, but establishing a long-term care grant program and then also funding a study through DEED to explore additional tax credits. I think it's all part of that studying. Let's keep learning, understanding, and talking to folks in the field, but this also does cover something with the study.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, I've learned the hard way around here that if you don't put in your study exactly what you want studied, it's not going to be studied. So I just would recommend to you, as this bill moves forward, that you would add something to make sure that that aspect gets studied. Otherwise, I can assure you that it won't be, at least, you know, not as part of this.
All right. Representative Newton.
One more question, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers and perhaps Mr. Schoenbaum, if we paid our employees salaries that are equal to or even better than what you're getting in other facilities in your areas, would we even need a loan program?
Ms. Thurl.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can at least take a start at answering your question if I understand it correctly. You're asked, and maybe if I can ask a clarification, if you're asking about competition within facilities in terms of wages, is if I'm understanding you correctly, I would say yes, we'll still need loan forgiveness. Because as you've heard from a number of testifiers, and I think you'll hear here in a moment, we don't just compete with other long-term care providers. We don't have a pipeline for enough people coming into long-term care to, you know, to actually adequately staff and recruit and retain. We're competing not just with healthcare, but manufacturing, agriculture, all the major economic sectors out there. And so we think loan forgiveness as a strategy is a way to encourage people to go where the jobs are going to be today and in the future. And that would be my perspective, but I think...
Just a brief follow-up to that.
Mr. Lucia.
Would be that, yes, that's consistent with what I was referring to, that a fundamental shift to careers in healthcare. As the CNAs come in, to me that's a very integral part, is to show them there's a path, there's a way to stay in healthcare, to develop, to grow. That's the progression to wages, is to the LPNs, to the RNs, to the supervisory roles. That's the model that I think this type of loan reimbursement program provides. It starts us down that path to be, it's a different conversation with the young CNAs. There's a career in healthcare. We're going to help you get there, and they end up staying with you. So that's my perspective on the value of the loan program.
Mr. Representative Baker, you had a follow-up to that, too?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, again, Representative Newton asks a good question. I think I would hope philosophically this debt forgiveness program is not something that will be here for many, 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 many years. I hope that the industry finds ways to find new revenues and new ways of promoting great careers in this. And I think good tax policy, or good, really sound policy for what we're actually talking about today, hopefully quickly gets folks looking at us seriously. But in a long-range plan, we have a way to lessen the burden on taxpayers with debt forgiveness in the long range. There's no sunset to this today, but I hope someday. These industries are well-funded. They have lots of folks on the bench coming out of college ready to go to work. This is just we have an adjustment period here we have to get through. So I hope long-term this is something that we can address in a different manner.
And reminder to members, we do have one more bill with the 12 minutes we have left in committee. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick factual question. How does the number of loan forgiveness applicants we could accommodate compare to the number of open positions that we're attempting to fill for nurses specifically?
That's a question that's probably best answered by Mr. Schoenbaum, if he's willing to come forward. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Yurusha, I'll try and be sensitive to the time, but I think I only have half the answer. The loan forgiveness program is, as it stands now, a small program with about 15 new awards a year. A handful of those are nurses. So compared to the vacancies in the industry, it's a modest response.
Representative Yurusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to find the number. I think we had something on the order of 1,800 open positions was quoted at some point in one of these presentations. So I just wanted to highlight the fact that we need to remember that this is only one piece of what we would need to do to address the shortages. And considering the fact that the major pressure, as was pointed out, is the wage gap between what we're able to pay in long-term care and what our hospitals are able to pay, that is going to be an ongoing thing we need to deal with.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. We have Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's real brief, so you can move on. But I really thought the gentleman from Tealwood was really powerful testimony. I'm going to try to get that book and read it if I can. But it's, I think a lot of our discussion, and I think Representative Newton was kind of getting to it, was, the wages are, such a component, and I just don't know how you're still going to be able to get employees if you're not paying them. So it's just, that's going to be tricky. Representative Baker, my question is to you, what's the number? Do you have a number? What's this cost? How big are you going? How big is the problem? And we all know it's big. So what kind of number you're talking. We got $200 million on the nursing homes, that maybe more on the main on bill. But I'm just curious what this the cost you're figuring on this, Representative Baker.
Representative Baker.
Well, again, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly. I'm not sure I'm real qualified to answer that after being here about 4 or 5 weeks. So what I have learned in a very fast manner is that the hard decisions that were made a number of years ago with severe budget shortfalls in our spending, and there was tough decisions that had to be made, now is the time that we have to look at sort of this market adjustment correction to get the nursing facilities back where they need to be. This one small component, I think we have a fiscal note out of it around 200. We don't have a fiscal note yet? Okay. So I don't know what that is. I think, again, we were talking anywhere from 180 to 200 million when it comes to, you know, getting the fees and the rates back where they should be. However it ends up, I'm not sure, but I know it's significant. And I hope that, you know, this legislature, this session, will do some really good work for that area. And I know that there's a lot more work yet to be done. So I wish I could give you a more firm number, but I know it's going to be significant.
Mr. Chair, just
and it's my understanding that a fiscal note will be available during the next Finance Committee that the bill goes through, so it'll be ready for then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker. I'm just starting to get, you know, worried as we're going down the road. You look at the, I like to go through every bill that's put in, and you know, there's all these great ideas, and you know, and this actually, I would agree is a great. You know, I'm a co-author and on this and the next one. I think they're good and helpful. I continue my wage part of it, but anyways, the I'm just starting to worry. You know, we have a surplus, but the end of the day, I mean, it's really getting. So you got, you know, we're almost $1 billion maybe on that, but you know, of course, we don't factor in inflation. I don't know if I didn't really know what that meant as a freshman, and you're a business owner, so you probably, you know better than I did at that point. But it's scary. But, you know, the money really isn't, there isn't much left. So we've got a couple $100 million with Representative Schumacher's. We got a lot of bills out there on transportation. So, you know, I like your idea, but we're running out of money fast. So get your money in, get your request in fast, because our seniors need it.
Thank you, Representative Lilly and Representative Baker, and I will bring that to the Finance Committee when it gets there. Are there any other testifiers to this bill? Seeing no other testifiers, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 614, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic Workforce Development and Policy. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 627, Representative Franson, and she will be making the motion to move this to the same Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy Committee. Is that correct, Representative Franson?
That is correct, Chair Schumacher. Thank you. So I do have an amendment, Day 1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Franson, please present your amendment.
The A1 simply does this. Rather than list the health professionals by profession, it allows the Commissioner of Health flexibility to expand the loan forgiveness program to the healthcare fields where the need is the greatest with regards to those working in nursing homes or intermediate care facilities. This amendment also states that individuals can qualify for either loan forgiveness program or the employee scholarship program. They cannot qualify for both programs, so this assures no double dipping. It also okays the Minnesota Department of Health offered technical assistance, and understanding is that they are okay with the amendment on this as well.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Franson.
I do believe that there's two
you
other
You want to take
amendments?
The other amendments up before you present? Okay. The next amendment we have then is the A3 amendment by Representative Newton, very similar to the last amendment.
It,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is the same as the last amendment, and I'd like to ask Representative Franson to accept it as a friendly amendment.
Absolutely.
All right. All in favor, are there any other questions for the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. The A3 amendment is adopted. We also have the A5 amendment from Representative Yaruso, which is also very similar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, again, this is the same amendment, same wording as last time, same arguments, and I hope Representative Franson will accept it.
You bet, Representative Yaruso.
All right. Any questions for either? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, same sign. The A5 amendment is adopted. Representative Franson, two-year bill as amended.
That's great. Well, first, I'd like to say anytime that I can hold hands on a bill with SEIU, it's a good day. So yay us, huh? This bill, as referenced by the presentation by MDH and Deed, there is a great need for the development of the long-term care workforce. My bill works to address those long-term care workforce challenges by doing the following: expanding the health care professionals education loan forgiveness program to incentivize health professionals to work in Minnesota nursing homes, expanding the scholarship eligibility for nursing facility employees, and also by directing Deed and MDH to review existing workforce development programs and to report to the legislature their recommendations on staffing rural long-term care facilities. And I stand, Mr. Chair, for any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Franson? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, could you just tell us, like, what's similar and what's different from the last bill we spent so much time on?
Representative
Franson.
I think at the end of the day, I think these bills might end up being merging because they are similar in nature. What we have here is, do you have a copy of the other bill, 614? I can go over line by line.
614. So, Representative Franson, on to that, it looks like Section 5 and Section 6 of the other bill are the new, are the parts that are significantly different, the long-term care study and the long-term care grant program.
Yep.
Which are additions in the previous bill, but not in this bill.
That is correct.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Representative
So, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding then, Representative Franson, so yours is the same, except it lacks some of what the other one.
That is
it's correct. A little less than the one we just heard. A
few less pieces of paper.
Okay.
All right, any other questions? Would anyone from the audience wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Franson, then renews her motion to move House File 627 and have that be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic Workforce Development Policy, all in as amended. Representative Yaruso.
Just a quick comment about the previous discussion about the differences. This one includes healthcare facilities for persons with a developmental disability. Was that?
Yes, you are absolutely correct.
Yeah, I think that's one of the
that is. Yes, thank you. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. House File 627 has been re-referred as amended. With that, members, I think that's it for our agenda today, so we are adjourned.